It's my great honor to introduce you to the next speaker of this afternoon, and that is Alan Guelzo, who is the Director of Civil War Studies at Gettysburg College. He's going to discuss for us Lincoln's Four Roads to Emancipation. In addition to his position as director, Professor Guelzo is also the Henry R. Luce Professor of Civil War Era at the Gettysburg College. He holds a master's and a doctorate in history from the University of Pennsylvania. Professor Guelzo is the author of many books and many other works, including his most recent books, Fateful Lightning, A New History of the Civil War and Reconstruction, and Gettysburg, The Last Invasion, which spent 8 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. He has also written for the Washington Post, for the Los Angeles Times, the Wall Street Journal, and has been featured on NPR's programs Weekend Edition Sunday and On Point, as well as on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Please join me in giving a very warm Sooner welcome to Professor Guelzo.
Thank you, President Boren and Dr. Harper, for the opportunity to be here, and Professor Hart for that introduction. And thank you, as an audience, for being here today. It does me good to see so many people who are interested in hearing about the history of our country. Of course, I have the privilege of living in the midst of that history in Gettysburg. You might say that I'm in the epicenter of Civil War interest in this country. Everywhere you go in Gettysburg, there's something there to remind you that Gettysburg was also a battle. Gettysburg may be the only town in the entire country where you can walk around at any time in 19th century dress and nobody thinks it's strange. But even there, I'm aware of a certain degree of failure in our national historical consciousness. On July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd of this past year, we celebrated the sesquicentennial of the Battle of Gettysburg. And noticeable by their absence were any representatives of the major networks, television or radio. Oh, there were some of the affiliate stations, but none of the heavy lifters had really deemed it all that important to be there for the 150th anniversary of Gettysburg. And it was a significant and painful omission. But what compensated for that omission were the people who attended those 3 days of commemoration. Somewhere between 250 and 325,000 people came to Gettysburg in the 10 days on either side of the battle anniversary. And it's not that they were simply there in numbers. They were there with a certain concentration and seriousness of purpose that belied the size of the crowd itself. I remember having gone back over the site of the high water mark on the Gettysburg battlefield after the crowds had dissipated from the July 3rd commemoration, and I was impressed by the fact that there were no trample marks, no tire marks, no plastic water bottles, no detritus left. It was as though the people who had crowded there only 2 hours before had themselves had a sense of how important the events that had occurred there had been and were treating that ground accordingly. People were there because they wanted to know and to remember and to honor. And I think that many of you are here today for some of those same reasons. And that is a good thing. The great Russian dissident, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, once said that whenever tyrants seek to conquer a people, one of their first steps is to erase that people's memory of their history. Because by doing so, then, captive peoples have nothing with which to compare their miserable situation in the present with what had been different in the past. The past, you see, is a weapon that tyrants fear. And to be able to deploy one's history is, in fact, a step, a gesture in defense of freedom. All of us, I think, are here today because we share some sense of it. And that certainly is why I do so much of it as I do. But now let me talk about President Lincoln. To stand in the presence of Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation is to be in the company of an extraordinary document in human history. It is one of the most sweeping presidential actions in all of our nation's past, greater in its impact on the lives of more people in one generation than any presidential act before it, and still alive with consequence for every generation after it. Lincoln's proclamation dwarfs in scope the Louisiana Purchase, the New Deal, the Panama Canal, the Great Society, even the Affordable Care Act. It achieved the reversal of the single greatest oversight of the Constitutional Convention, and that was the Constitution's failure to deal directly with slavery. It was the Emancipation Proclamation which lopped off slavery's head and made it possible, 2 years and 1 month later, to drive a stake in the form of the 13th Amendment through slavery's vampire heart. All honor, then, to Abraham Lincoln as the proclamation's author. He was happy in his life, for he was the restorer of the Republic, said the premier among American historians in 1865, George Bancroft. He was happy in his death, for his martyrdom will plead forever for the union of the states and the freedom of man. William Cullen Bryant, the poet and editor, added this laurel: "Thy task is done, the bond are free, we bear thee to an honored grave, whose noblest monument shall be the broken fetters of the slave." There are, in fact, many ways in which Lincoln almost made the task of emancipation look too easy. And we might well wonder if a presidential proclamation was all that was needed to paralyze slavery, then why did he wait 22 months into his presidency to issue it? Well, the most obvious reason is Lincoln's acute sense of what was politically possible. 11 states of the American Union loved slavery so much that they had seceded, formed a Southern Confederacy to protect it, and plunged the nation into civil war. But the remaining 24 states of the Union did not hate slavery so much that they were willing to fight for its end. 4 of the most important, Kentucky, Maryland, Missouri, and Delaware, actually kept legalized slavery on their statute books. And they did not mind telling Lincoln that emancipation proclamations of any sort would be the signal for them to desert to the Confederate side. As Lincoln himself bluntly explained to his friend Orville Hickman Browning, the very arms we had furnished Kentucky would be turned against us. Nor was that the only objection. Entirely apart from the practical considerations of stampeding Missouri and Kentucky into the arms of the Confederacy, Joshua Speed, his oldest friend, reminded Lincoln that federal proclamations, whether from presidents or generals on the subject of slavery, were directly against the spirit of the law. The laws of slavery in Kentucky, as elsewhere, were state laws. And Speed said, "Our Constitution and laws both prohibit the emancipation of slaves among us, even in small numbers. Proclamations from Lincoln or any other federal authority had no constitutional power to override state statutes." And Speed was, unhappily, right. Not only did Lincoln have, in ordinary civil administration, no constitutional authority to practically indulge my primary abstract judgment on the moral question of slavery, it was not clear that he had any authority under the wider umbrella of the so-called laws of war to emancipate slaves. Or at least, there was, under those laws of war, no precedent for doing so. The modern usage of war, wrote the soldier-turned-lawyer Henry Wager Halleck in his 1861 textbook on international law. The prevailing rule is not to touch private property on land. Well, slaves were chattel property. Ergo, the title of slave owners to their slaves could not be rewritten. Even when the conquest of a country is confirmed by the unconditional relinquishment of sovereignty by the former owner, there can be no general or partial transmutation of private property in virtue of any rights of conquest. This was not because Henry Halleck was indifferent or inhumane. On the contrary, restraining war and war's reach over property was itself supposed to be humane. For 300 years, European jurists writing on international law had struggled to defang the potential of war for barbarity and unlimited destructiveness, first by limiting the right of going to war to sovereign states, and secondly, making the legitimacy of war rest on satisfying certain formal conditions between the combatants, without regard to considerations of religion, of justice, of truth, of purity, all of which it was feared might tend to inflame what was in wartime already a potentially brutal affair. American jurists shared this worry, and they even prided themselves on keeping American warfare an affair of professional soldiers so as to soften the extreme severity of the operations of war by land. So when it came to property in war, the United States Constitution specifically banned bills of attainder in Article 1, Section 3, bills of pains and penalties, which alienated even the property of traitors. And no one less than John Marshall, the great Chief Justice, declared in 1814 that the modern usage of nations is to abstain from confiscating the debts due to an enemy or his property found within the territory at the breaking out of war. According to this idea, when property falls directly into the hands of a belligerent, the right to the debts and the property is only suspended during the war and revives with the return of peace. Even property directly used in the making of war, so-called contraband of war. Remember that phrase, it's going to come back. Even contraband of war could be seized only for use, not for ownership. War gives the right to confiscate, John Marshall said, but does not itself confiscate the property of the enemy. And that included slave property. From the time of Hugo Grotius, the most celebrated of all international jurists in the 17th century, it was understood that in war, a slave also who has fallen into the hands of an enemy, upon his release from thence, returns to the service of his former master. And Americans confirmed this by the way that they devoted themselves to securing the rendition of slaves who had fled to the British armies during the Revolution and the War of 1812. 23 of Thomas Jefferson's slaves ran away during the Revolution. He succeeded in obtaining from the British the return of at least 5 of them, whom he promptly re-enslaved. The Treaty of Ghent, ending the War of 1812, explicitly guaranteed the rendition of slaves or other private property in 1814. And deliberations over that rendition dragged on until 1826, when the British finally settled all claims for $1.2 million in spot cash. The twin cliffs of the Constitution and the laws of war did not therefore present Abraham Lincoln with many options for pursuing an emancipation agenda. And given the added restraint imposed by the chilliness Northern whites manifested toward the practical consequence of emancipation, the wonder is that Lincoln ever bothered to give the subject a second thought. It is certainly imaginable that he might have taken the low road and never introduced the subject of slavery and emancipation into the Civil War at all, because there were so many short-term incentives for him to have done just that. But in fact, he did. His revulsion at chattel slavery sprang from sources deeply embedded in the man. "I am naturally anti-slavery," he said. "If slavery is not wrong, nothing is wrong. I cannot remember when I did not so think and feel." Slavery was something founded in the selfishness of man's nature, a monstrous injustice which deprives our Republican example of its just influence in the world, enables the enemies of free institutions, with plausibility, to taunt us as hypocrites. Slavery was indistinguishable, Lincoln said, from the tyranny of kings. It was only convictions of such a depth that could have overcome the manifest disincentives to pursue an emancipation policy. And yet, despite the disincentives, there were, as it turned out, four roads that might be taken toward emancipation. The problem for Lincoln was that each of them entailed certain risks, and with no guarantee of success, and their path ahead disappeared into a murk of legal uncertainty. The first of these roads to emancipation was one which Lincoln himself had always favored, a gradual emancipation program, sweetened by the offer of compensation to slave owners and authorized by state legislative action. Or, as he put it in a letter to Horace Greeley in the spring of 1862, a plan with three main features: gradual, compensation, and the vote of the people. Plans for gradual, compensated emancipation had been both successful and peaceful in many of the northern states, in Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, and rid those places of slavery. What was more, gradualism minimized the social shock of emancipation in ways which generated no noticeable racial hostility from the surrounding white populations. "In my judgment," Lincoln explained, "gradual and not sudden emancipation is better for all. It would allow slave states to adopt some practical system by which the two races could gradually live themselves out of their old relation to each other and both come out better prepared for the new." This would, of course, be of small consolation to the slaves, because gradual emancipation held out a promise of freedom in the future rather than freedom itself at once. And lingering in the shadow of gradual emancipation plans was the not very discreet hint that much of this gradual emancipation could be attached to plans for the gradual transportation and colonization of the freed slaves somewhere outside the United States, to West Africa, where there were already two sizable but not very attractive freedmen's colonies in Liberia and Sierra Leone. Lincoln himself had given a perfunctory endorsement to colonization in his 1852 eulogy for Henry Clay, and in speeches in 1854, 57, and 58 in Peoria, Springfield, and Edwardsville, Illinois. Although it has never been clear how serious Lincoln was about colonization, Surely, if he had been as deeply racist or as enthusiastic about colonization as his critics sometimes suggest, it's peculiar that he put so little energy into making colonization happen. But this, as Lincoln said, is a world of compensations, of trade-offs, so to speak, rather than absolutes or either-ors. And if the trade-off for emancipation had to be gradualism or compensation, he would take the trade-off. It sure beat civil war. By the fall of 1861, he had already devised a compensated emancipation plan for the border slave state of Delaware. Slaves born in Delaware after adoption of the plan would be automatically free as they reached the 35-year mark. The Delaware legislature would be provided with $719,000 in 6% United States bonds to buy out the slave owner's interest. Depending on the timetable the Delaware legislature adopted, slavery would cease to exist in Delaware not later than 1872. With that example in place, the same plan could then be offered to the other three border states, and that would take so much wind out of the Confederacy's sails that the rebellion itself would collapse, and the process could be begun in the South. If Congress will pass a law authorizing the issuance of bonds for the payment of the emancipated Negroes in the border states, Lincoln explained, Maryland, Kentucky, and Missouri will accept the terms, and gradualism would bring slavery to an end. And, he might have added, they would do it as a purely civil procedure, originating within the states, and thus neatly sidestepping any accusations of federal overreach on his part. Congress, however, had its own ideas about the road to emancipation. In late May 1861, three fugitive slaves showed up at the gates of Fortress Monroe, the last surviving toehold of federal authority in Confederate Virginia. Their master was a Confederate officer, and they had been put to work constructing Confederate fortifications. They ran away, and they wanted refuge at Fortress Monroe. The commandant at Fortress Monroe, Benjamin Butler, was a Massachusetts Democrat who had, quixotically, supported Jefferson Davis for the presidency in 1860. He's also just about the ugliest general in the history of the Civil War. However, when the owners of the slaves demanded the return of these slaves as fugitives, Butler turned around and declared the slaves to be contraband of war and refused. The notion that slaves could be considered contraband was a nice joke at the expense of their Confederate owner. But hadn't the slave owners all along insisted that slaves were property? Very well, Benjamin Butler concluded, we'll treat them the same way as any other war-making property and confiscate them as contraband. After the debacle of the Union forces at Bull Run in July, it was too tempting for Congress not to leap onto the back of this idea and expand it into the First Confiscation Act, providing that slave owners who allowed their slave property to be used in promoting insurrection or resistance to the laws would make that property lawful subject of prize and capture and forfeit all right to such service or labor. This was followed 11 months later by a second Confiscation Act, which expanded the application of confiscation to include every person who shall hereafter commit the crime of treason against the United States. Confiscated slaves, moreover, shall be declared and made free. Nor was Benjamin Butler alone among the soldiers who were tempted to lay a hand on slavery in this fashion. Among them was a former Republican candidate for the presidency, Major General John Charles Fremont. Placed in charge of the Department of Missouri, Fremont quickly showed an extraordinary lack of military competence, but a finely honed sense of the political. And in August of 1861, Fremont imposed martial law, first on St. Louis and then on the rest of the state. Violators of the martial law decree would suffer the seizure of property, real and personal, and their slaves, if any they have, are hereby declared free men. Butler had merely confiscated the slaves who knocked at his door. Fremont, purely by the authority of martial law, cut out the middleman and declared the slaves free. Other soldiers, lacking Fremont's boldness, just looked the other way when fugitives sought out their camps, and then pretended that they had seen no such evil when angry slave owners demanded rendition of their property. You can imagine this pretty easily, I think. Fugitive slave runs away to a friendly Union Army encampment. Union Army encampment takes in the runaway slave. Angry slave owner shows up at the picket line demanding rendition of the slave. Soldiers of the Union encampment tell slave owner to take a long walk off a short pier. Slaves? No, we haven't seen any slaves. What'd you say his name was? No, haven't heard. Nobody of that name here. No, no one who looks like that either. No, nobody from that neck of the woods. No, I'm sorry. No slaves, no fugitives here. Goodbye. Yes, this is a bayonet. It has a point. Finally, in April of 1862, the new commandant of the occupied districts along the Carolina coast, Major General David Hunter, declared his own version of martial law, and not only declared all slaves in his district free, but enlisted 500 of them as the first South Carolina volunteers. Finally, it has to be said that in addition to Lincoln's plan of gradual emancipation, and Congress's plan, and the general's plans for confiscation, the slaves themselves had their own plan for freedom, which was to use the distraction of the war and the diversion of so much of the South's white male population as the opportunity simply to run away, usually into the arms of an increasingly compliant U.S. Army. Slaves seized their chances to escape, wrote Secretary of War Edwin Stanton. Discontent and distrust were engendered. The hopes of the slave and the fears of the master, stimulated by the success of the federal arm, shook each day more and more the fabric built on human slavery. Everywhere across the South, but especially wherever the Union armies marched, hundreds of colored people obtained passes and free transportation to Washington and the North, and made their escape to the free states. Day after day, the slaves came into camp, and everywhere that the stars and stripes waved, they seemed to know freedom had dawned to the slave. Slave owners in the ineptly named Georgia County of Liberty complained to their local Confederate commandant that, from ascertained losses on certain parts of our coast, we may set down as a low estimate the number of slaves absconded and enticed off from our seaboard as 20,000, and their value as from 12 to 15 millions of dollars, to which loss may be added the insecurity of the property along our borders and the demoralization of the Negroes that remain. Although the sheer transience of the fugitives makes it difficult to peg the actual number of runaways with accuracy, it's very likely that between 200 and 250,000 slaves bolted from slavery during the Civil War. Now, after all this, it becomes a very interesting question to ask, which of all of these roads finally ended up being the one which led most directly to emancipation? And the answer is, as in so many maddening historical answers, all of them and none. Vincent Harding was the first in 1981 to articulate what has become known as the self-emancipation thesis, that the slaves freed themselves by resistance and by flight. It has become a popular thesis ever since, and no wonder. It has a rattlingly revolutionary ring to it, derived in large part from its connections with Marx's declaration in the Critique of the Goethe Program in 1875, that emancipation of the working class will be the task of the working class itself. And it also satisfies a need to see emancipation as an object which African Americans seized for themselves, rather than a gift bestowed by indulgent white people who would thereafter demand unending gratitude for their generosity. According to the self-emancipation thesis, these self-freed slaves, along with their white abolitionist allies, in turn exerted such pressure on Lincoln that he was compelled to end his long hesitation over emancipation and issue the proclamation on January 1, 1863. There is more than a little truth to the idea that slaves exerted pressure for emancipation, but ironically, because it was not the slave fugitives who did the pressuring, but the still enslaved black laborers in the Confederate armies. By performing the logistical and fatigue duties which in the Union armies were performed by white soldiers, Confederate slaves were making a direct contribution to the Southern war effort, which even the most flint-hearted Northern racists were willing to see undercut by emancipation. But the fundamental problem with imputing this pressure to the fugitives and contrabands lies in these two considerations. First, even free blacks in the Northern states lacked access to the ballot box, or many other civil freedoms, for that matter. And without it, it is hard to imagine what pressure fugitives and contrabands were in a position to exert on Lincoln or anyone else. Second, while it is true that fugitive slaves could free themselves by running away, the freedom they achieved was only de facto freedom, the temporary freedom that any fugitive from law or power enjoys, not de jure freedom, the freedom which enables one to stand up in civil society without fear or trembling as a citizen. And if, for any reason, the Union decided to come to the negotiating table at any point with the Confederacy, the past record of demands for rendition of fugitives would certainly have set off an unholy pursuit of the contrabands by their quondam northern protectors, especially if rendition of those fugitives and contrabands was made a condition for peace. That sort of freedom would require something of much greater impact than mere flight, no matter how heroic. It would not come, however, from the generals and from martial law proclamations of freedom, if only because there was no effective jurisprudence on the nature of martial law in American legal history. Martial law is a thing not mentioned by name and scarcely as much as hinted at in the Constitution and statutes of the United States, admitted Caleb Cushing, one-time Attorney General, in 1856. I say we are without law on the subject. The generals might have declared a suspension of the writ of habeas corpus, because the suspension of the writ is the key assumption in martial law. But suspending the writ did not extend to its executors the power to alter title to property. And anyway, there was already a substantial amount of contest going on between Lincoln and Chief Justice Roger Taney about suspending the writ of habeas corpus without odds and ends of generals muddying the waters. It did not improve Lincoln's peace of mind, especially in Fremont's case,
to be told that the proclamation of General Fremont is most inopportune for the Union Party. That, according to Kentucky Senator Garrett Davis. The general principle of the martial law is so far modified by the Constitution as to have no effect for a longer time than the life of the rebel. Lincoln revoked Fremont's proclamation and then relieved him of command in Missouri. He did likewise to David Hunter the following spring. Something of the same problem attached to the Confiscation Acts. Although Lincoln signed both of them, he did so with ill-concealed reluctance. And in the case of the Second Confiscation Act, not until Congress passed a resolution affirming that confiscation would not function as a bill of attainder. Congress could pass as many confiscation acts as it liked, but Lincoln had to keep an eye on the likelihood that they would be challenged as unconstitutional. And in that case, the challenge would be handled, in the end, by no one less than Roger Taney, who would have been only too happy to put a permanent blockage in the path of emancipation, just as he had tried to put one on keeping slavery out of the Western territories in the Dred Scott decision in 1857. But Lincoln's own cherished gradual emancipation plan actually fared no better. Inducing the legislatures of slave states like Delaware to do the work of emancipation themselves in exchange for a federal buyout made perfect sense to a lawyer like Lincoln. But white slave owners in Delaware and elsewhere preferred racism to money. And all of the gradual emancipation schemes Lincoln proposed for the border states were thrown back in his face. Only in the District of Columbia, where Congress had direct constitutional jurisdiction, was a compensated emancipation plan finally hatched, and successfully. Elsewhere, Lincoln was tartly informed to mind his own business. "Confine yourself to your constitutional authority," the border state congressman told him on July 14, 1862. "Confine your subordinates within the same limits. Conduct this war solely for the purpose of restoring the Constitution to its legitimate authority." There was yet one more road to emancipation, but it was one only Lincoln himself could walk, and that reluctantly. Whatever else the Constitution prevented Lincoln from doing, it did empower him in at least one key respect, and that was to designate him as Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy of the United States when called into the actual service of the United States. It had never been very clear what powers this title conferred on the president, but as early as the 1830s, John Quincy Adams had announced that those powers included a presumed set of war powers, which would include emancipating slaves if a war emergency required it. With every other tool breaking in his hand, 1 week after being told by the border state delegations that he had no business thinking about emancipation, Lincoln submitted to his cabinet the first draft of an emancipation proclamation predicated on these war powers as commander-in-chief. He knew that he had no direct precedent for this, and this meant taking a terrible constitutional risk. "I think the proclamation is valid in law, but whether war powers proclamations are binding or not will be a question for the courts," which is why, when he issued the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation on September 22, 1862, he headed the rationale for it as, "By virtue of the power in me vested as Commander-in-Chief and as a fit and necessary war measure." This is also why he added such a lengthy list of exceptions to the application of the proclamation when he signed the final version of it on January 1st, 1863, because the areas he exempted, 13 parishes in Louisiana, the city of New Orleans, 7 counties and 2 cities in Virginia, the whole of West Virginia, these were excluded for the simple reason that these areas had been returned to the civil jurisdiction of the United States. They were no longer subject to his war powers. This is also why, above all other things, the Emancipation Proclamation is written in such deadeningly legalistic terms. Because over top of all the questions of justice, policy, and timing, Lincoln had a hostile federal judiciary to deal with the scarecrow Tawney at its head. And one false legal step would set Tawney at the throat of the exposed proclamation in a fashion which might set emancipation back for another generation. It's easy to jump to the conclusion that coming from a president capable of such rhetorical gems as the Gettysburg Address or the second inaugural, that the woodenness of the Emancipation Proclamation, by the way, notice I did not arrange to have copies of it handed out. Ron has the advantage on me there. I mean, handing out the second inaugural is like handing out Shakespeare. If you hand out the Emancipation Proclamation, people say, whereas. But this was not Lincoln's own estimate. People sometimes assume that the language, the legalistic language of the proclamation, somehow reveals a man whose heart was only half in the project, if that much. But Lincoln knew otherwise. Once the proclamation took effect, Lincoln remarked, the character of the war will be changed. It will be one of subjugation and extermination. Emancipation, he said, will be pushed after the 1st of January, 1863, with all the power left in the federal arm. And thereafter, he would shape his policy in a direction more radical than ever. Not only would the war change, but the character of slavery would change. Because the slaves who fell within the ambit of the proclamation are and henceforward shall be free. Not merely loose, or at large, or on the run, but free, legally, and forever. It takes nothing away from the struggles of the slaves to say that freedom came to them as the act of a white man. Because Lincoln did not issue the proclamation as a white man, as though he were handing out gifts to people who could thereby be resented if somehow they did not behave as humble children. He issued the proclamation as the President of the United States and the Commander-in-Chief. The slaves themselves certainly had no problem linking their fortunes to Lincoln's proclamation. The African-American war correspondent Thomas Morris Chester wrote that the proclamation ends the days of oppression, cruelty, and outrage founded on complexion and introduces an era of emancipation, humanity, and virtue founded upon the principles of unerring justice. The proclamation, said Chester, protects the sanctity of the marriage relationship, justifies the natural right of the mother over the disposition of her daughters, and gives to the father the only claim which Almighty God intended should be exercised by man over his son. When freedmen were interviewed by a congressional committee on Reconstruction in 1866 and asked when they considered themselves free, the answers were unanimous. When the proclamation was issued, and I have been a slave from my childhood up to the time I was set free by the Emancipation Proclamation, and under the proclamation of the President of the United States, I consider myself a free man. There was, in the end, nothing easy about the Emancipation Proclamation. It involved false hopes and false starts. And the fourth and final road Lincoln adopted in order to reach emancipation through a War Powers Proclamation was itself ripe with legal dangers, some of which remain with us today. We of this time and this generation tend to be dismissive of a regard for legal dangers. In an age awake to considerations of humanitarian justice, we are inclined to look cynically upon law as merely the tool of the powerful. But law is lasting, while power is not. And Lincoln's anxiety to connect the proclamation with law, even at great risk, is a hallmark of statesmanship, not hesitancy. The passage of a century and a half may have reduced our vision of the risks Lincoln took, but they were real ones all the same. And yet, even in the face of those risks, Lincoln was adamant. I think I shall not retract or repudiate it. Those who have tasted actual freedom, I believe, can never be slaves or quasi-slaves again. Thanks to the proclamation, they never would. Thank you very much.
Probably have time for a couple of questions. I've got one here.
Is it your opinion that Lincoln's only objective with the Emancipation Proclamation was freeing of the slaves? It had nothing to do with international politics.
No. No, if anything, Lincoln was aware of the fact that by issuing the Emancipation Proclamation, he was liable to trigger an international intervention. The Prime Minister of Great Britain, Lord Palmerston, along with his Secretary of State, Secretary for Foreign Affairs, all were terribly exercised by this Emancipation Proclamation because they assumed, as many other people did in that time, that the issuance of the proclamation would immediately be followed by a slave insurrection and a bloodbath of white people all across the South. Now, this was not necessarily because the British were all that tender about the condition of white people in the South or any other place. What they didn't want to see was their supply of cotton permanently interrupted. But either way, the British had only a few years before been through one racial bloodbath in the form of the Sepoy Mutiny in India in 1857 to 58. They had seen what happened when one race was arrayed against another race. It was not pretty. I think we better...